Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There is no greater threat to the free world today and in the future than the Chinese Communist Party. We will be discussing for this full hour just how serious that threat is with a woman who has personally experienced it firsthand in China, her native land, and who has come to the United States in a kind of Horatio Alger success story, made her way, established herself as a very successful businesswoman and as a political candidate for high office in several states of our country. She's been a formidable contributor, I think, to our national awareness about challenges we face from the CCP, as it's called, and what we need to be doing about it. And we're going to explore all of that and more with Lily Tang Williams in the course of this hour-long conversation on the occasion of a very dark day in history, truly a day that should live in infamy, the 100-year anniversary of the founding of the Chinese Communist Party. Lily, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio.
Well, thank you for having me, Frank. Good talk with you.
It's good to be able to talk with you, especially on this day that has been marked with great festivities and celebrations, mostly in the form of a kind of cult of personality of Xi Jinping, the dictator, the leader of the Chinese Communist Party. Lily, let's start by just trying to level set, as they say in the military, to calibrate on the magnitude of the danger this party represents to, well, not only the people of China and East Asia, but truly the world, including our own. Talk a little bit about your own personal experiences at the hands of the CCP before you fled.
Well, I was born just 2 years before Mao's Cultural Revolution. I was born in Chengdu, Sichuan province. My parents were actually illiterate, working poor class. So we had no idea about outside world. We were indoctrinated as children in government schools, and we lived on food rationing coupons as a so-called workers class, the proletarian rural society. But we had the least amount of food rationing coupons because, you know, my parents were not high up inside of a communist party. I just remember my mom had to beg for her salary increase to fit family of, you know, three children. And when I heard it, I was very insulted. But regardless, I was indoctrinated by Communist Party, by Mao. I went through entire Cultural Revolution with him, thought he was like a god until he died at age, when I was 12 years old. And then later, the Communist Party come out to say, sorry, Mao was not a god. He was human. His 10 years Cultural Revolution was a mistake. And I had a little bit of brain left to think, to ask questions to myself. Was I lied to? Was whole China lied to? So that's why I decided later I wanted to study law in order to search for truth. Maybe we should have a society based on rule of law instead of a man who can die, who is not God, who make mistakes. And all today you look at and Politburo, seven men ruling over 1.4 billion Chinese. So I wanted to search for truth. And then I was told by CCP again in law school, the law was just tool used by the party to rule the masses, all the Chinese. So many of them are just the masses. They're not individuals with dignity and. So I was lost again until I become faculty member to teach in the same law school because I wanted to stay in Shanghai, not get sent back to Chengdu, which was more isolated Western China. And I realized my dream after I become faculty member My dream will never become true rule of law society. I was being naive because after I become law school faculty, I was forced. You have to join Communist Party in order to teach in law school. You got to show your loyalty to the party. And we had to go to political study meetings every week as faculty members. And our lectures have to be approved. My social life with my students, or just when you're younger, was criticized because I would go to dancing party with my friends who are like one or two grades lower. So after all that, the first year, I was so depressed. I was young when I graduated, like 21. Should I stay in China or should I flee for a free country called America? Because I know about Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, which is coming up this Sunday. The founding father's words, all men are created equal, really gave me this hope for this new country. So finally, I basically woke up early compared with my peers to say, I got to leave China. I have to, no matter what I have to do. And I couldn't tell anybody if I fled, I'm not going back because I have to sign an agreement to promise I will go back. You need the permission to apply for passport to leave China. So they said, well, if you don't come back, we're going to kick you out of the party. And that's okay. And then we're going to send you a personnel file, you know, to Chengdu. That means I can never go back to Shanghai to work, to live legally. And I had to bite that. That means I have no way to turn back. I have to come to this country with nothing and make something out of myself and to stay here.
This is such an impressive story. Yeah. You found yourself over this period learning more and more, obviously, about the repressive character as well as the you know, lust for power of the Chinese communists and their willingness to do anything to exercise it, to maintain it, and to subject the people of China to their ruthless oppression. So you sought freedom in the United States. Can you tell us how you managed to get out of the country? And obviously, you were obliged to give it all up. But talk a little bit about your experiences getting here, and then, you know, your early time adjusting to a very different kind of society.
Well, in order to leave, I had to change my strategy. Instead of a question, challenge my party boss in law school. Every school, university department has a communist party committee. People don't know that. Lots of people just don't have clue about China. So I had to change my strategy to go to study meetings. Instead of silencing them, I will have to participate, change my attitude, say kumbaya to the party. It's almost like when I was growing up, you say long live again, long live communist party. That's what people are saying today. Long live. It's 70 years now, and they have not seen the horrors of that party because of the massive propaganda by the, you know, department of the Communist Party to indoctrinate all their people, including all the youth and students. So I woke up earlier, but I had to change my strategy to flee. And so it took me 2 years to butter up my boss, get him to give me permission to quit my job, go apply for passport, and promise to go back to China. And then find an American sponsor, a university, UT Austin, accepted me and to study in graduate school legally with my time and with my money. And I just needed permission to go get a passport. So I had to pass TOEFL exam and raise money. I did not have money either. I mean, I had to get into debt with my American sponsor, borrow $1,200 for him so I will pay him back later in order to come to this country. But when I landed in Austin, Texas, 1988, May 11th, that was the happiest moment of my entire life. I said, I don't care. I only had $100. I couldn't speak English. This is a free country. I'm going to make it on my own. I never expected anybody to help me. But Texas people were so warm and welcoming. And they gave me free stuff, you know, kitchenware, bedding, clothing. And I even went to somebody's home. So they are host to me to live there for free where I clean and cook. And I learned English very quickly. And the neighborhood was very, very white neighborhood. That's why I feel my obligation to tell my story is that American people are wonderful people. I never feel discriminated because I am a Chinese lady in a Texas white neighborhood.
This is so heartening. And it brings me to a point that I wanted to explore with you, because having been through what you were subjected to in China, you have, I know, a familiarity with a phenomenon that is much in evidence at the moment and that your own personal story belies, namely this notion, this thesis, this theory, as it's called, that the United States is a systemically racist country, and that we need critical race theory to adjust us so as to end the white supremacism and the oppression of people of color and all the rest. Talk about this critical race theory business, Lily Tang Williams, if you would, in the context of Maoist doctrine and tactics for dividing and conquering, well, people and nations like ours.
Well, that I think a lot of people in this country are not taught or studied history on it. They don't recognize their tactics. I live in China for almost 24 years. I got scared for years in this country trying to tell my story to say, why are we talking like communist Marxists? Why are we constantly talk about equity, racial equity, want to have equal or communist terms? In order to reach so-called equity, you need to have a government to use force, to take, to redistribute wealth. That's what the Marxists want. So when I was in China, Mao used the same thing, like what people are talking about today, except it's critical class theory, that people are divided by Marxists into two groups, oppressor versus oppressed. And if under Mao, you are rich landlords and the farmers and the rightists and bad influencers and traders and dissidents, you belong to the oppressor class. It's all very subjective, abusive, you know, like terms. And the party can just put you under black class. And if you're black class, your life is hell during the Cultural Revolution. 20 million people died. They go to classical struggle sessions, and in the big public square, people hold red guards were used by Mao as useful idiots to hold their face up to wanted to make them public and shamed, self-criticize, self-apologizing, denounce their families and their ancestors and the children in order to draw the line with their black families, because it's such a huge amount of pressure for them, and they would have to come out to say, I cut ties with my family, I'll change my Chinese last name. There are lots of people change their last names during the Cultural Revolution in order to show their red child, their mouth loyalist, and they would cut ties with their family. And some people even turn on their families to red guards and watch their parents tortured to death. What kind of, you know, you cannot imagine. Those people are living guilt and just cannot even have a peace today.
This is such an important point, Lily, and I'm so glad you've brought it up, because we're told, among others, by the Marxists of Black Lives Matter, for example, the organizers, that one of their priorities is breaking up the nuclear family. This is obviously part and parcel of the kind of Maoist doctrine that you were subjected to, that you saw during the Cultural Revolution. Talk about, I mean, you mentioned the sense of guilt and shame that many of these people who did, in fact, turn on their families feel today. But just elaborate on what the impact is on a society, as you saw firsthand, of having the nuclear family destroyed in the service of essentially enhancing the power of the party.
Well, that's why people sometimes don't understand. I have been saying that identity politics separate people into those different groups, five red, five black, and today is by skin color, by race. But it's the same thing, because if you don't play identity politics, the Marxist communists cannot do their Cultural Revolution. Mao said we need to do Cultural Revolution because we need to get rid of the four old culture, ideas, customs, and their habits. So anything is subjective. They go to four O's, and the red guards were going door to door, looting people. If you had a Chinese traditional beautiful so-called dress, They will burn it. If you have old Chinese furniture, they will take away all the books, burn it. So people have to burn themselves before they come to loot your house because you're afraid to go to re-educational camp. Does that sound familiar with this country? Top down the statues and change the street names, the college or sports team names, and the looting. And the trained Marxists come out to say, it's okay to loot because, you know, we're supposed to get the repatriation. And then turn on families against each other. It's so sad for me to see. I'm terrified to see the similar tactics, but people don't recognize in this country. They think, you know, it sounds good, racial equity. And we need to, you know, do this. Go with cancel culture, wokeism, white supremacy, and domestic terrorism. It's all political game and terms are used to do a cultural revolution, similar to Mao style, divide and conquer.
It is the cultural revolution imported here by Marxists, I think it's fair to say, and it's part of their revolution against our country and against our form of government, our constitution, and so on. And I'm so appreciative that you're able to help connect these dots because we are witnessing it here as though it has no precedent, and we're not understanding, most of us, that it does and how these things, fit together. And I'm really appreciative, particularly of this point about identity politics, because again, this feeds directly into this notion that we want to divide people and undermine a sense of, one of our founding principles in this country, e pluribus unum, out of many one. And what the Chinese Communist Party is about is trying to fracture that sense of unity and national coherence in favor of, taking us down, I think, quite clearly. Let me ask you about a couple of these things, because in your country of origin, China, there was a magnificent history, a culture, civilization, predating basically everyone else's. Did the Red Guard, did the cultural revolutionaries, did Mao succeed in destroying that attachment to the ancient culture and traditions and ideas and customs of that magnificent civilization?
They did, unfortunately. If you compare with Taiwan, with Hong Kong, mainland China today, with 1.4 billion Chinese, they have a less of a Chinese traditions, culture, even concepts, and then Hong Kong and Taiwan. It's sad. That's another story. Talk about what they did to Hong Kong. But I lived in Hong Kong for 2 years, from 1996 to 98. I witnessed the turnover. I saw how entrepreneurs Hong Kong people were, how much traditional Chinese customers they keep, not in mainland China. And, when they talk about, we need to be nationalists, we want to, to be against the foreigners. But look, communism is a foreign ideology from Karl Marx. Tell you a story, how sad we were when we're in China. If you were about to die, you describe yourself as gonna die, or some bad accident gonna happen or something. And you will say, I'm going to say Karl Marx. When Chinese people die that time, they say the phrase is, I'm going to say Karl Marx. That's how crazy we become, and we worship a communist manifesto writer, a leader, and his Marxism never succeeded all over the world. But you got the Chinese dictator Mao to use that to advance his own agenda during the Cultural Revolution. One third of the cultural relics were destroyed because they belong to Mao's four olds. And the temples, Confucius temples, and the Christian churches, and Buddha's temples all burned down or shut down. And so some of them had to be restored after the, economical reform. And the famous phrase, when people were getting sick and dying during the Mao's Cultural Revolution, they would say, hey, I'm going to say Karl Marx. That means I'm dying. You're not talking about you're going to heaven. You are going to say Karl Marx. So he become like almost like a godlike figure because he's a communist leader. And of course, then later Mao become an even bigger god, and then Marx. So today's Chinese kids, under rule of CCP, they don't know anything about real history. The ruling party basically teach their version of history. And I was talking about before PRC, we had private properties in China, private enterprises, international commerce, and all the traditional Chinese values. When Mao lost some power due to the mass famine because his central planning policies during the Great Leap Forward, right? Like you're talking about 20 million to 40 million people starved to death, and there's no official figure. Then the Liu Shaoqi becomes the president of China. And Mao was very, very upset and mad. He left Beijing. Use propaganda like People's Daily and use young people like the Peking University students and to launch the Cultural Revolution because he wanted to call on young people, naive, idealistic, to worship him, to listen to him, to say, we have bad people in our party and we need to eliminate them. They are the revisionists or something like that. So he used young people like my uncle. Yes, counter-revolutionaries or dissidents or, you know, professors. And he basically used to shut down the school to say, let's do political struggle full time for those young people have time on their hands and go after all the dissidents, especially inside the party who were against him, make him to lose some power. And because of that campaign, the 20 million people died during the Cultural Revolution because the black classes families, like he classified them, and he classified five red under oppressed group. So he got them to fight each other, and all the useful idiots like Red Guards were basically used by him. Like my three uncles were Red Guards. Guess what? After 3 years of violence, that he become godlike leader, then he sent them to countryside. It's called a Down to the Mountain re-education campaign for those urban youth.
Yeah. So what you've described is the cynical exploitation of young people for the purpose of essentially regaining power that Mao was determined to do, and at terrible cost both to the society, which was devastated by this kind of turmoil and well, oppression at the hands often of these young Red Guards, as you say. And then, as is generally the case, the communists turned on those who had been central to their victory, in this case, banishing them to re-education programs and camps. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, and how it manifests itself these days in Chinese politics, the banishment and the purging and the brainwashing of people.
Well, after Mao become like a godlike, went back to Beijing, basically control all the power, become absolutely a supreme leader or godlike leader. Then he was reported by the Chinese army general that the young people, Red Guards, were become very violent and dead bodies flowing down the rivers in some places. So he's trying to figure out a way for them to come down and get them outside the cities because he finished using them. And so his policy is that if you are urban youth and you can, to the parents, you can only keep the youngest child at home with you, which was my aunt. My three older uncles have to all go to countryside, assigned by the government a job. They were excited at the beginning. Oh, I'm going to get paid. You know, they're high school students, never finished high school. My favorite uncle is only 17 years old. You're going to get paid. And then he went to Burma border and stayed there. They never knew what kind of life condition they would face, what kind of hard labor they would have to endure. And lots of people, like this movie banned by China called Xiuxiu, talk about Chengdu girl, my hometown girl, went to Tibet. And she killed herself. She could not come back to home, and she was raped and abused, and just all that, nightmares happened to her. My uncles could not even take a local girl, because if you marry a local woman, then you will never come back to cities, because your household registration will follow you to the countryside, to your spouse. So they were single for all those years. And finally, when they're trying to rise up to demand, we want to come back to the cities, our life, our families, and they were silent. Like the way they used by Mao to silence other dissidents. So, but I remember when I was young, here's a story nobody can tell you, is that the young people had to plan a mass suicide to write big posters, put on the wall with their bloody fingerprints. Let us come home to the cities in Chengdu, or we're going to kill ourselves on the railway track, lying our body down. So that got attention. And they start to let the parents retire so their kids can eventually come back and to take their jobs.
Their jobs, yeah. This describes an attitude towards people, in this case the Chinese people, that is horrifying to contemplate. And needless to say, the wholesale indifference to their needs, let alone any rights that they may have, bespeaks really the most totalitarian of systems. And the idea that anyone would want to replicate such a thing or experiment with introducing it into a country like ours is almost unimaginable. But there are folks who have that in mind. I think there's no doubt about it. Lily, let me ask you about one other thing about China that is another example of such repression on the one hand and indifference to humanity. Population control is something that has been instituted in China now for, I think, some 40 plus years. Initially, the so-called one-child policy. Talk, if you would, a little bit about how that manifested itself in China and the kind of apparatus that was established to ensure that women would not get pregnant or have children that were not authorized by the state.
Well, that it started in the 80s because, after Mao died, the economy was about to collapse. And Deng Xiaoping started economic reforms. Then instead of blame on central economy planning policies, central planning, they blame on population. So they said we have limited resources. It always happens in the communist countries. That's why you live on food rationing, because of the bad system. But they blame on population. So they want to limit people to one child. And you accept very few exceptions. So if you want to have a second child, then the consequence is very severe. You will get even pushed out of party, no state jobs, no good jobs, and your kids cannot have a benefit, like be part of the official household registration where you go to public schools, you get a public health benefit. It was a brutal. Some women will be literally forced, grab the woman to put on the table to do forced abortion. And I had one roommate in law school. She was doing internship in one hospital in Shanghai. She said that she could not go back. She told us one baby was born alive, late term, and thrown into trash can and crying for a few minutes. She said, I just cannot go back. This gave me nightmares, and then died, of course. That's a human baby inside a trash can. Then now they want you to have a second child and propaganda to promote second child. Now they said, we need a third child policy and propaganda ever to force people to consider have third children because they, a lot of families don't want to. They cannot afford to. They don't have the economic to support it. So it's all about the control. Women were never left alone when it comes to the family, life and choice. And it's all about force. The government propaganda is so powerful. It's like every day, every second in your life, it's propaganda.
Yes. I want to come back to that point about propaganda, but just staying with the population control. A colleague of mine, a member of our committee on the present danger China, by the name of Reggie Littlejohn, who runs a terrific outfit called Women's Rights Without Frontiers, has described the apparatus of this population control program as a womb police, which is to say that at the very most primal level, you have the state inserting itself into the private condition of women. Their menstrual cycles are a matter of public notice, for example. And if God forbid any of them actually do get pregnant, the community has, snitches that will rat them out and put in motion these kinds of forced abortions that you've spoken of. Is that true? And what does it say, again, about the system that would promote such behavior?
It is true. First of all, in China, since you were born, you were tracked by government. So when you want to get married, you need both you and your husband's work unit, so-called employers, to give permission. There might be a line for you to wait. If you want to marry so long, you cannot get permission to marry. Now, when you say, I want to have my child now, then you get application done again and to be put on the waiting line to say, well, it's not your turn yet. You cannot get pregnant yet. So now, and now because of the population policy started one child in the 80s, then they want to track your period, what time a month you normally come with a period. And they do want everybody spy for the state. If you think they think that they're doing a good job for the state, for the public good by tracking their neighbors who is tummy is rising again, might be pregnant and might supposed to, not to have that child and did not get permission or this is second child. It's just 100% police state. When I come to this country and listen to the audiobook 1984, I was shocked. I said that this is exactly what I went through and what the people still going through in China today. And it's amazing that people don't truly realize how inhuman, what is a crime against humanity by them to infringe your privacy every day.
What has happened since you left China, of course, has immensely increased the power of the state and the intrusiveness of its womb police and other mechanisms of control, namely something called the social credit system. Are you familiar with this phenomenon and how it operates and what it means for the people of China that this surveillance state, well, it's George Orwell on steroids, I think, is now capable of monitoring everything about you down to the most intimate of detail.
Well, that even though I come to the United States 1988, because I do watch and listen to Chinese news, some are underground reporting, and I'm pretty much in touch with, what's going on in China. The social credit system is nothing new. It's just a digital big tech extension of their old tracking system. I mentioned it. Household registration, like national ID, that depend, that confine you to where you should live. You cannot just pack your bag and move into another province. No, you cannot. You need a permission. And another system is individual tracking called from student file to personnel file. It's basically from birth to death tracking. But now we have internet, we have a cell phone. And they heard about United States credit system that's for mortgages and all that with point system. So they designed this social credit system that which is tracking people by their cell phone. Everybody has to have a cell phone and cell phone number. All the cash transactions basically are eliminated. You need to use a cell phone to buy, to sell, to communicate, to study, to do social media. And then they, based on your behaviors, your group speeches and WeChat groups, and to give you minus points or plus points. If you get a minus point very low, like below 600 or something, then you cannot go purchase train tickets. Forget about international travel, even domestic travel by airplane, by train, you cannot buy it. And that will affect your job, will affect your children's schooling, and your mortgages, will get denied. And basically use this to keep everybody on the government CCP side to report on citizens and to distance you and stay away from those people who might be dissident, anti-government. Because if they say something in your group on your WeChat, then your score will drop, your point will drop.
You can be implicated by something they may say.
So the whole society limiting censorship into every minute, every, you know, household. Is that scary? I don't know why we are trying to learn from China in the Western democracy countries. Talk about vaccine passport, a QR code on your cell phone. Our world has gone insane.
Though I want to just drill down on that for a moment. As it happens, we're speaking before the event, but by the time this program airs, we will have had a webinar on this subject, and you'll be able to find video of it, I believe, at stopvaxpassports.org. That's stopvaxpassports.org. But Lily, we were examining in the course of this program precisely this point, that in the name of combating the virus that the Chinese Communist Party apparently cooked up in a biological weapons laboratory and either deliberately unleashed upon us or certainly exploited once it was leaked out of that laboratory in a way that is very similar to a kind of biological attack, we are responding by not only using these vaccines, which have been developed, you know, on a very accelerated basis, but we are insisting that people, or some of us are at least insisting, some in government, some in businesses for sure, are insisting that people have to register their vaccination status as part of a more comprehensive dossier, shall we say, the digital dossier. And the comparison has been made to the way the Chinese Communist Party and its social credit system operates. Are you, I take it you are, but just explore that with us, if you would. What are the implications for the country that you've come to, that you clearly love, that you've benefited enormously from and contributed very substantially to, if we go down that road?
Well, I followed the COVID very carefully. Before even it come to United States, I saw the Chinese cover up and the censors, doctors, and lie to population. And then later, when they did admit, that was like 1 month or more later, 5 million people have already left Wuhan to travel for Chinese New Year all over the world. So it was weaponized, laboratory, and the WHO covered for them. And I don't know, you know, how much truth did our government officials know about that? And the fact the whole world has gone Chinese style authoritarian to force on masks, vaccines, and shut down stay home, shut down school, churches. I'm very worried. I think that looks like the communists all over the world, globalists, have taken over the Western democracy countries. We cannot even go to Europe or Canada now without vaccine passport to travel. It's like 1984 all over again. For me, I have made a YouTube video where vaccine passport become like China's social credit system. I think that's what is intended. If you can track your population, especially the dissident, and the government has a system to determine, have this power over you, you must do certain things. And so your freedom of rights are not from God anymore. They're from your government officials, politicians, and bureaucrats. So you don't have rights and freedom unless we give you the permission. You know, I feel sad. Why half the Americans were buying to that? We have to rise up now. I was so worried last year. Where are the freedom-loving Americans to resist, to peacefully protest? Many of them, I don't even say thousands of them. You know, now I'm very loud and talking about this and to say, are we becoming China? They are the biggest threat now to our freedom and democracy, but our politicians were saying white supremacy is our biggest threat. It's like, are you kidding me? Talk to all the immigrants like me.
Lily, I'm so delighted that we are talking with you. And again, our guest is Lily Tang Williams. And I should have mentioned before now, but let me say it. You've alluded to your YouTube channel. It is Lily, that's Lily Tang, T-A-N-G, Williams, on YouTube. And also you can follow Lily at Lily for Liberty on Twitter. These are important outlets, and I'm so glad that you are utilizing them to help spread this warning, this terribly urgently needed appreciation of the extent to which our country is, in fact, now increasingly, it seems, acceding to not just the ambitions of the Chinese Communist Party to dominate others, but to insinuate itself into our nation for the purposes of, well, as Barack Obama used to say, fundamentally transforming it. Lily, let me just pick up on something else that that you've alluded to here. The censorship that is part and parcel of the CCP's modus operandi, if you will, towards its own people. It blocks access to the internet. It has the great firewall to keep information that it doesn't want its people to receive from getting in. And through other means, among these, the social credit system, as you say. If they can monitor what you're listening to, or at least what you're saying about things, you can be silenced, that's for sure. But Lily, to your point, we're watching censorship taking place increasingly in this country as well. How reminiscent is this of what you experienced yourself in China? And do you think it is in the service of this fundamental transformation to make us more like the Chinese?
Well, that's why I'm worried to death, terrified. We are becoming China because I have seen that the cancel culture, big tech censorship on social media. I was fact-checked and warned many times on Facebook. And I also heard my friends constantly in Facebook jail or Twitter shutdown. And you would think classic liberals, ACLU, all those civil liberty union people should come out, condemn this censorship, condemn this infringement of free speech, even free press. People cannot publish books now without the mobs going after them, you know, kind of trying to take them off the shelf. This is all communist. How come people don't realize that? Communists, it's not just in Beijing anymore. They are all over the world. They are our country, and they have infiltrated into our country through Confucius Institute and through businesses, some Chinese scholars, some Chinese students, all indirectly or directly work for the Chinese government. There are spies everywhere. People like me, that's why lots of Chinese have to be quiet, because they can be tracked and reported and threatened in this country by speak up against them. I have to manage my fear. I have families in China. But if I don't speak up, I always count on other people speak up. That's how we lose a free country.
That's right. That's exactly right. Speaking of that phenomenon, Lily, you know, I'm sure, that there are, by some estimates, 330,000 or so Chinese students in our country. All of them have been approved to come here, as you were, by the Chinese Communist Party. They have, many of them at least, families at home. And there are frequent reports that the Chinese use these individuals, these students, to advance their agenda in this country. And if they don't voluntarily do so, it is, after all, something they are obliged to do under the national intelligence law of China, to defend and support the motherland if asked to do so by the party. But they are also susceptible to having their families threatened with punishment if they don't play ball with the party. Talk a little bit about that and what a, well, counterintelligence threat it represents to our country to have such a vast number of people who may be collecting information or even recruiting, you know, professors or others to work for the party back in China.
Well, we have to go by sometimes, you know, there are two groups of people in this country. And one group is really hired by Chinese, like they have a huge budget for their United Front propaganda department. They even hire funding, be aware, you know, American face, the YouTuber to Kongbaiyang and cheer for Chinese leadership and for the CCP and the, everything about China to make China look good. And another side, they have infiltrated into our media, our press, like People's Daily newspaper, the largest official Chinese newspaper, were sent to our elected congressmen and representatives and senators. And through the U.S. newspapers, now you have the researchers and scholars come from China, the international students come to the United States with paying foreign international student tuitions and to directly or indirectly work for Chinese government. Some came by themselves, some came with official channel. You don't know who is who, like you said. China is one party ruling state. If they have family there, they know all your family members' data and where they live and who they are. You have to work with them. You have to do your duty as a patriot. Otherwise, we're going to threaten your family members, or you might never be able to go back to China again. It's typical mob rule. The Communist Party is the largest totalitarian state and the mob rule in the world. And they use this to threaten people.
We think of it as a transnational criminal organization, actually, because it has committed such massive crimes against humanity and of every other kind, against us in this country, our businesses, our intellectual property, our military, and so on. And it seems to me that it should be designated as such, Lily, and punished for being so.
Right. Another thing I want to add, our media don't call them out. They don't call China out for their case numbers and death numbers. They were busy fighting, our own president last year. But they also do not call out today on the 100 years of CCP funding. How about what they're doing Chinese today? The Uyghur cultural genocide and the Falun Gong and political prisoners and the Tibetans. He is the Tibetans' new spiritual leader now. And they don't talk about what the Chinese doing to all of the world through Silk Road Initiative, infrastructure, international projects.
Belt and Road Initiative.
Extension of their power. Yeah, this extension of their power and the influence. Xi Jinping wants his China dream to become true by 2049. What is his Chinese dream? It's not a Chinese people dream. It's a CCP dream to become the number one dominating force, take over the United States as largest economy and largest, force in the whole world. Can you imagine our world is ruled by one party state? The whole world will be a very dark place. It's time to fight and to speak up now.
Amen. And Lily Tang, we appreciate so much your willingness to do so with us in the course of this program. We only have a couple of minutes left, Lily, and I did want to ask you about one other affront to humanity and another, I think, very important message to Americans about what we're up against here. Talk, if you would, a little bit about the oppression by the Chinese Communist Party of faith communities. You mentioned the Uyghurs there and Tibetans. Christians are also being brutally persecuted in China, as are, needless to say, the Falun Gong practitioners. But what is it about faith communities that has made them the special target of the Chinese Communist Party? And what else can you tell us about the toll that it is taking in those communities?
That's why I always tell Christian conservative friends, I was raised as a Buddhist, and it doesn't matter which religion you believe during the communist Mao time, you all were banned because they want communism to be your only religion and your party leader like Mao to be your god. So they're in competition with other faiths. And now, today, Christians, you cannot go to home churches. It's banned. You can get arrested. And you have to get a state license if you want to have your own churches in China today. And they want the cross come down from your building. It's called like a Christian entity with China, special characteristics or something like that.
And they're amending, as I understand it, the Ten Commandments. I think they're down to 9 now.
Or rewrite Bible. They want to
rewriting the
Bible too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So they want to shut you down. Look at that. They shut down churches too last year. And you can have a bar open, you can have other stuff open, but you cannot have church open, school open. Like what are our people, so-called elected officials here, politicians, what are they trying to achieve? They purge the people who disagree with them, who don't support their policies. Then they give favors and choose and pick. And I think that I don't know how many people who infiltrate into our government in Washington, D.C. are socialist communists. We got to call them out. Because they could shut down people, half of the country, just because they don't agree with our policy.
Amen. Well, and Lily, just very quickly, and this is probably our last question for today. At the top of that food chain in our government, of course, is Joe Biden. You've studied, I'm sure, what we've learned from his son Hunter's laptop about the degree to which the Chinese communists have their hooks into the Biden family. Knowing what you do about the party, knowing what you do about its ambitions, what should Americans understand about the implications of having the commander-in-chief of this country compromised, deeply compromised?
Well, I think it's more than just Hunter Biden. It's all the lots of other specially connected powerful politicians, their relatives will go to China, get a special treatment and special deals. I don't want to name them, but we have governors left that are pro-Beijing. You can Google that online, how many governors, maybe your state governor, is listed by Chinese Communist Party. They're pro-Beijing. They can do business together. It's a threat to our constitutional rights when you have elected politicians who are willing to compromise to benefit themselves and their families to make lots of money. I don't want to condemn private corporations. If you want to do that, I can boycott them, but I cannot boycott the politicians in D.C. who are compromised. How do I boycott their laws they pass? They might be even, the Chinese Communist Party is very smart. They know who is possible to be compromised and whose family is doing what. They also know racial division in our country is a weak spot, our civil society. And they want to get interfere with that to push for that rhetoric. So everybody is like a focus on something. We fight tooth and nail against each other. Where they went, they had the Chinese documents I read 2016 to interfere with the U.S. election. And the racial tension is our weak spot. And we need to get the Chinese companies come here, buy land, buy companies, invest, and get their voters out to vote for their candidates. Wake up, America.
We do need to wake up, America. And you have helped us do that, I think, with this very important conversation. Lily Tang Williams, follow her on Twitter at Lily for Liberty and check out her YouTube channel, Lily Tang Williams. Please come back to us, Lily, with further insights into the challenges we're facing here, in part as a result of what the Chinese Communist Party is doing over there, and in part what they are helping to be done in our own country. We appreciate so much your visit with us and the work you do. Keep it up, and we'll talk with you again soon. I hope we'll talk with the rest of you again tomorrow.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you, and Rich Higgins.